Chapter 14. He declares that he saw, the day before, 504 brothers of the order led to the stake because they would not confess the above-mentioned errors, and he heard it said that they were burned. But he fears that he himself would not resist if he were to be burned, that he would confess in the presence of the Lord Magistrates and anyone else, if questioned, and say that all the errors with which the order has been charged are true, that he, if asked, would also confess to killing our Lord. Testimony of Emery de Villiers-le-Duc, May 13, 1310. A trial full of silences, contradictions, enigmas, and acts of stupidity. The acts of stupidity were the most obvious, and because they were inexplicable, they generally coincided with the enigmas. In those halcyon days, I believed that the source of enigma was stupidity. Then the other evening in the periscope, I decided that the most terrible enigmas are those that mask themselves as madness. But now I have come to believe that the whole world is an enigma, a harmless enigma that is made terrible by our own mad attempt to interpret it as though it had an underlying truth. With the collapse of the Christian kingdoms of the Holy Land, the Templars were left without a purpose, or rather they soon turned their means into an end. They spent their time managing their immense wealth. Philip the Fair, a monarch intent on building a centralized state, naturally disliked them. They were a sovereign order beyond any royal control. The Grand Master ranked as a prince of the blood. He commanded an army, administered vast landholdings, was elected like the emperor, and had absolute authority. The French treasury was located in the temple in Paris, outside the king's control. The Templars were the trustees, proxies, and administrators of an account that was the king's only in name. They paid funds in and out and manipulated the interest. They acted like a great private bank, but enjoyed all the privileges and exemptions of a state institution. The king's treasurer was a Templar. How could a ruler rule under such conditions? If you can't lick 'em, join 'em. Philip asked to be made an honorary Templar. Request denied. An insult no king could swallow. He suggested that the Pope merge Templars and Hospitallers and place the new order under the control of one of his sons. Jacques de Molay, Grand Master of the Temple, arrived with great pomp from Cyprus, where he lived like a monarch in exile. He handed the Pope a memorandum that supposedly assessed the advantages of the merger, but actually emphasized its disadvantages. Molay brazenly argued that, among other things, the Templars were far wealthier than the Hospitallers, that the merger would enrich the latter at the expense of the former, thus putting the souls of his knights in jeopardy. Molay won the first round. The plan was shelved. The only recourse left was slander, and here the king held good cards. Rumors about the Templars had been circulating for a long time. Imagine how these colonials must have looked to right-thinking Frenchmen, these people who collected tithes everywhere while giving nothing in return, not even, anymore, their own blood as guardians of the Holy Sepulchre. True, they were Frenchmen, but not completely. People saw them as pieds noirs. At the time, the term was poulain. The Templars flaunted their exotic ways. It was said that among themselves they even spoke the language of the Moors, with which they were familiar. Though they were monks, their savage nature was common knowledge. Some years before, Pope Innocent III had issued a bull entitled De Insolentia Templariorum. They had taken a vow of poverty, but they lived with the pomp of aristocrats, with the greed of the new merchant classes, and with the effrontery of a corps of musketeers. The whispering campaign was not long in coming. The Templars were homosexuals, heretics, idolaters, worshipping a bearded head of unknown provenance. Perhaps they shared the secrets of the Ismailis, for they had had dealings with the assassins of the Old Man of the Mountain. Philip and his advisers put these rumors to good use. Philip was assisted by his two evil geniuses, Marigny and Nogaret. It was Marigny who ultimately got control of the Templar treasury, administering it on the king's behalf until it was transferred to the Hospitallers. It is not clear who got the interest. Nogaret, the king's Lord Chancellor, in 1313 had been the strategist behind the incident in Anagni, when Chiara Colonna slapped Boniface VIII, and the Pope died of humiliation less than a month later. Then a man by the name of Escain de Flourens appeared on the scene. Apparently, while imprisoned for unspecified crimes and on the verge of being executed, Flourens encountered a renegade Templar in his cell and from him heard a terrible confession. In exchange for his life and a tidy sum, Flourens told everything. which turned out to be exactly what everybody was already rumoring. Now the rumors became formal depositions before a magistrate. The king transmitted Flourens' sensational revelations to the Pope, Clement V, who later moved the papal seat to Avignon. Clement believed some of the charges, but knew it would not be easy to interfere in the temple's affairs. In 1307, however, he agreed to open an official inquiry. Molé, the Grand Master, was informed, but declared that his conscience was clear. At the king's side, he continued to take part in official ceremonies, a prince among princes. Clement V seemed to be stalling, and the king began to suspect that the Pope wanted to give the Templars time to disappear. But no, the Templars went on drinking and blaspheming in their commanderies, seemingly unaware of the danger. And this is the first enigma. On September 14, 1307, the king sent sealed messages to all the bailiffs and seneschals of the realm, ordering the mass arrest of the Templars and the confiscation of their property. A month went by between the issuing of this order and the arrest on October 13th. But the Templars suspected nothing. On that October morning, they all fell into the trap and, another enigma, gave themselves up without a fight. In fact, in the days before the arrests, using the most feeble excuses, the king's men, wanting to make sure that nothing would escape confiscation, had conducted a kind of inventory of the temple's possessions throughout the country, and still the Templars did nothing. Come right in, my dear bailiff, take a look around, make yourself at home. When he learned what had happened, the Pope hazarded a protest, but it was too late. The royal investigators had already brought out their irons and ropes, and many knights had begun to confess under torture. When they confessed, they were handed over to inquisitors who had methods of their own, even though they were not yet burning people at the stake. The knights confirmed their confessions. This is the third mystery. Granted, there was torture, and it must have been vigorous, since 36 knights died in the course of it. But not a single one of these men of iron, seasoned by their battles with the cruel Turk, resisted arrest. In Paris, only 4 knights out of 138 refused to confess. All the others did, including Jacques de Molay. What did they confess? Belbo asked. They confessed exactly what was charged in the arrest warrant. There was hardly any variation in the testimony, at least not in France and Italy. In England, where nobody really wanted to go through with the trial, the usual accusations appeared in the depositions, but they were attributed to witnesses outside the order, whose testimony was hearsay. In other words, the Templars confessed only when asked to, and then only to what was charged. Same old inquisitional stuff, we've seen it often, Belbo remarked. Yet the behavior of the accused was odd. The charges were that during their initiation rites, the Templars denied Christ 3 times, spat on the crucifix, and were stripped and kissed in posteriori parte spine dorsi, in other words, on the behind, then on the navel and the mouth, in humane dignitatis opprobrium. That they then engaged in mutual fornication, that they were then shown the head of a bearded idol which they had to worship. Now, how did the accused respond to these charges? Geoffroy de Charnay, who was later burned at the stake with Molay, said that, yes, it had happened to him. He had denied Christ, but with his mouth, not his heart. He didn't recall whether he spat on the crucifix because they had been in such a hurry that night. As for the kiss on the behind, that also had happened to him, and he had heard the preceptor of Auvergne say that, after all, it was better to couple with brothers than to be befouled by a woman, but he personally had not committed carnal sins with other knights. In other words, yes, it's all true, but it was only a game. Nobody really believed in it, and anyway, it was the others who did it. I just went along to be polite. Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master himself, said that when they gave him the crucifix, he only pretended to spit on it and spat on the ground instead. He admitted that the initiation ceremonies were more or less as described, but to tell the truth, he couldn't say for sure, because he had initiated very few brothers in the course of his career. Another knight said that he had kissed the master, but only on the mouth, not the behind. It was the master who kissed him on the behind. Some did confess to more than was necessary, saying that they had not only denied Christ, but also called him a criminal, and they had denied the virginity of Mary, and they had urinated on the crucifix, not only on the day of their initiation, but during Holy Week as well. They didn't believe in the sacraments, they said, and they worshipped not only Baphomet, but also the devil in the form of a cat. Equally grotesque, though not as incredible, is the pas de deux that now begins between the king and the pope. The pope wants to take charge of the case. The king insists on seeing the trial through to its conclusion. The Pope suggests a temporary suspension of the order. The guilty will be sentenced, then the temple will be revived in its original purity. The king wants the scandal to spread, wants it to involve the entire order. This will lead to the order's complete dissolution, politically, religiously, and, most of all, financially. At one point, a document is produced that's a pure masterpiece. Some doctors of theology argue that in order to prevent them from retracting their confessions, the accused should be denied any defense. Since they have already confessed, there is no need for a trial. A trial is required only if some doubt about the case exists, and here there is no doubt. Why allow them a defense whose only purpose would be to shield them from the consequences of their admitted errors? The evidence renders their punishment inescapable. But there is still a risk that the Pope might take control of the trial, so the king and Nogaré set up a sensational case involving the Bishop of Troyes, who was accused of witchcraft by the secret testimony of a mysterious conspirator named Nofodei. It will be discovered later that Dei lied, and he will be hanged for his trouble, but in the meantime the poor bishop is publicly accused of sodomy, sacrilege, and usury, the same crimes as the Templars. Perhaps the king is trying to show the sons of France that the church has no right to sit in judgment on the Templars, since it is itself not untouched by their sins. Or perhaps he is simply giving the Pope a warning to stay away. It's all very murky, a crisscrossing of various police forces and secret services, mutual infiltrations and anonymous accusations. The Pope is now cornered, and he agrees to interrogate 72 Templars who repeat the confessions they made under torture. But the Pope observes that they have repented and uses their abjuration, a trump card, as an excuse to pardon them. And here something else happens. It was a problem I had to resolve in my thesis, but I was torn between contradictory sources. Just when the Pope has finally won jurisdiction over the knights, he suddenly hands them back to the king. Why does this happen? Molay retracts his confession. Clement allows him a defense, and three cardinals are summoned to interrogate him. On November 26, 1309, Molay proudly defends the order and its purity. He even goes so far as to threaten its accusers. But then he is visited by an envoy from the king, Guillaume de Plaisant, whom Molay considers a friend. He is given some obscure advice, and 2 days later, on November 28, he issues a meek and vague deposition in which he claims to be a poor, uneducated knight, and he confines himself to listing the, now remote, merits of the temple, its acts of charity, the blood the Templars shed in the Holy Land, and so on. To make matters worse, Nogaré suddenly arrives and reminds everyone that the temple once had dubious contacts with Saladin. Now the implied crime is high treason. Molay's excuses are pathetic. He has endured 2 years in prison, and in this deposition he seems a broken man, but he seemed a broken man immediately after his arrest, too. In March of the following year, Molay adopts a new strategy in a third deposition. Now he refuses to speak at all, saying that he will address the Pope himself, but no one else. A dramatic twist, and here the epic theater begins. In April of 1310, 550 Templars ask to be allowed to speak in defense of the order. They denounce the torture to which they have been subjected and deny the charges against them. They demonstrate that all the accusations are implausible. But the king and Nogaré know what to do. Some Templars have retracted their confessions. Fine. Their retraction only makes them recidivists and perjurers. Relapsi, a terrible charge in those days. He who confesses and repents may be pardoned, but he who not only does not repent, but also retracts his confession, forswears himself, and stubbornly denies that he has anything to repent, he must die. 50 such perjurers are condemned to death. It is easy to predict the response of the other prisoners. If you confess, you stay alive, though locked up, and you can wait and see what happens. If you do not confess, or worse, if you retract your confession, you go to the stake. The 500 surviving retractors retract their retraction. As it turns out, the ones who repented chose wisely. In 1312, those who have not confessed are sentenced to life imprisonment, whereas those who confessed are pardoned. Philip is not looking for a massacre, he just wants to dissolve the order. The freed knights, broken in mind and body by 4 or 5 years in prison, quietly drift into other orders. All they want is to be forgotten, and this silent disappearance will fuel the legend of the order's underground survival. Molay was still asking to be heard by the Pope. Clement had convened a council in Vienne in 1311, but Molay had not been invited. The suppression of the order is ratified and its property turned over to the Hospitallers, though temporarily it is to be administered by the king. Another 3 years go by, and finally an agreement is reached with the Pope. On March 19, 1314, in front of Notre Dame, Molé is sentenced to life imprisonment. He reacts with a surge of dignity. He had expected the Pope to allow him to exculpate himself. He now feels betrayed. He knows that if he retracts yet again, he will be condemned as a recidivist and perjurer. What does he feel in his heart as he stands there after almost 7 years awaiting judgment? Does he regain the courage of his forebears? Or does he simply decide that, ruined as he is now, condemned to end his days in dishonor, buried alive, he might as well die a decent death? Because he protests in a loud voice that he and his brothers are innocent. The Templars, he says, committed one crime and one crime only. Out of cowardice they betrayed the temple. He will do so no longer. Nogaret is overjoyed. A public crime requires public condemnation. Definitive, immediate. Geoffroy de Charnay, the Templar preceptor of Normandy, follows Molay's example. The king makes his decision that very day. A pyre is erected at the tip of the Ile de la Cité. At sundown, Molay and Charnay are burned at the stake. Tradition has it that before his death, the Grand Master prophesied the ruin of his persecutors, and indeed the Pope, the king, and Nogaret all die before the year is out. Once the king is gone, Marigny comes under suspicion of embezzlement. His enemies accuse him of witchcraft and have him hanged. Many begin to think of Molay as a martyr. Dante himself voices widespread indignation at the persecution of the Templars. And that is where history ends and legend begins. One part of the legend insists that when Louis XV was guillotined, an unknown man climbed onto the block and shouted, "Jacques de Molay, you are avenged." That was more or less the story I told that night at Pilades, with constant interruptions. Belbo, for instance, would ask, "Are you sure you didn't read this in Orwell or Kessler?" Or, "Wait a minute, this is just what happened to that, what's-his-name, that guy in the Cultural Revolution." And Dio Talevi kept interjecting, sententiously, "Historia magistra vitae," to which Belbo responded, "Come on, cabalists don't believe in history." And Dio Talevi invariably answered, "That's just the point. Everything is repeated in a circle. History is a master because it teaches us that it doesn't exist. It's the permutations that matter." "We still haven't answered the real question," Belbo finally said. "Who were the Templars? At first you made them sound like sergeants in a John Ford movie, then like a bunch of bums, then like knights in an illuminated miniature, then like bankers of God carrying on their dirty deals, then like a routed army, then like devotees of a satanic sect, and finally like martyrs to free thought. What were they in the end?" "Probably they were all those things. What was the Catholic Church?" a Martian historian in the year 3000 might ask. "The people who got themselves thrown to the lions or the ones who killed heretics? All of the above." "But did they do those horrible things or didn't they?" "The funny thing is that their followers, the Neo-Templars of various epochs, say they did, and they offer justifications. For instance, it was like fraternity hazing. You want to be a Templar? Okay, prove you have balls. Spit on the crucifix, and let's see if God strikes you dead. If you join this militia, you have to give yourself to your brother's heart and soul, so let them kiss your ass." An alternative thesis is that they were asked to deny Christ in order to see how they would behave if the Saracens got them, which seems idiotic because you don't train someone to resist torture by making him do, even if only symbolically, what the torturer will ask of him. A third thesis, in the East, the Templars had come into contact with Manichaean heretics who despised the cross, regarding it as the instrument of the Lord's torture. The Manichaeans also preached renunciation of the world and discouraged marriage and procreation, an old idea common to many heresies in the early centuries of Christianity. It was later taken up by the Cathars, and in fact there's a whole tradition claiming that the Templars were steeped in Catharism. And this would explain the sodomy. Also, only symbolic. Let's assume the knights came into contact with Manichaean heretics. Well, they weren't exactly intellectuals, so perhaps, partly out of naivete, partly out of snobbery and esprit de corps, they invented a personal ceremony to distinguish themselves from the other crusaders. They performed various ritual acts of recognition without bothering about their significance. And that Baphomet business? Many of the depositions do mention a figura Baphometi. but this may have been an error made by the first scribe, an error copied into all subsequent documents. Or the records may have been tampered with. In some cases there was talk of Mahomet, istut caput vester Deus est et vester Mahomet, which would suggest that the Templars had created a syncretic liturgy of their own. Some depositions say that they were also urged to call out Yalla, which could be Allah. But the Muslims didn't worship images of Mahomet, so where does the object come from? The depositions say that many people saw carved heads, but sometimes it was not just a head, but a whole idol, wooden, with kinky hair, covered with gold, and always with a beard. It seems that investigators did find such heads and confronted the accused with them, but no trace of them remains. Everyone saw the heads and no one saw them. Like the cat. Some saw a gray cat, others a red cat, others still a black cat. Imagine being interrogated with a red-hot iron. Did you see a cat during the initiation? Well, why not a cat? A Templar farm where stored grain had to be protected against mice would be full of cats. The cat was not a common domestic animal in Europe back then, but in Egypt it was. Maybe the Templars kept cats in the house, though right-minded folk looked upon such animals with suspicion. Same thing with the heads of Baphomet. Maybe they were reliquaries in the shape of a head, not unknown at the time. Of course, some say Baphomet was an alchemic figure. Alchemy always comes up, Diotalevi said, nodding. The Templars probably knew the secret of making gold. Of course they did, Belbo said. It was simple enough. Attack a Saracen city, cut the throats of the women and children, and grab everything that's not nailed down. The truth is that this whole story is a great big mess. Maybe the mess was in their heads. What did they care about doctrinal debates? History is full of little sects that make up their own style, part swagger, part mysticism. The Templars themselves didn't really understand what they were doing. On the other hand, there's always the esoteric explanation. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were adepts of Oriental mysteries, and even the kiss on the ass had a ritual meaning. Do explain to me briefly the ritual meaning of the kiss on the ass, Diotalevi said. All right. Some modern esotericists maintain that the Templars were reviving certain Indian doctrines. The kiss on the ass serves to wake the serpent Kundalini, a cosmic force that dwells at the base of the spinal column in the sexual glands. Once wakened, Kundalini rises to the pineal gland. Descartes' pineal gland? I think it's the same one. A third eye is then supposed to open up in the brow, the eye that lets you see directly into time and space. This is why people are still seeking the secret of the Templars. Philip the Fair should have burned the modern esotericists instead of those poor bastards. Yes, except that the modern esotericists don't have two pennies to rub together. Now you see the kind of stories we have to listen to, Belbo concluded. At least I understand why so many of my lunatics are obsessed with these Templars. It's a little like what you were saying the other day. The whole thing is a twisted syllogism. Act like a lunatic, and you will be inscrutable forever. Abracadabra, manotecal fares, pape Satan, pape Satan alepe, la vierge le vivace et le bel aujourd'hui. Whenever a poet or preacher, chief or wizard, spouts gibberish, the human race spends centuries deciphering the message. The Templars' mental confusion makes them indecipherable. That's why so many people venerate them. A positivist explanation, Diotalevi said. Yes, I agreed. Maybe I am a positivist. A little surgery on the pineal gland might have turned the Templars into hospitalers. Normal people, in other words. War somehow damages the cerebral circuitry. Maybe it's the sound of the cannon or the Greek fire. Look at our generals. It was 1 o'clock. Diotalevi, drunk on tonic water, was clearly unsteady. We all said good night. I'd enjoyed myself. So had they. We didn't yet know that we had begun to play with fire, Greek fire, the kind that burns and destroys. Chapter 15. Erard de Civray said to me, "My lord, if you think that neither I nor my heirs will incur reproach for it, I will go and fetch you help from the Comte d'Anjou, whom I see in the fields over there." I said to him, "My dear man, it seems to me you would win great honor for yourself if you went for help to save our lives. Your own, by the way, is also in great danger." Joinville, Histoire de Saint-Louis, 46-226. After that evening of the Templars, I had only fleeting conversations with Belbo at Pilades, where I went less and less often because I was working on my thesis. One day there was a big march against fascist conspiracies. It was to start at the university, and all the left-wing intellectuals had been invited to take part. Magnificent police presence, but apparently the tacit understanding was to let things take their course. Typical of those days, the demonstration had no permit, but if nothing serious happened, the police would just watch, making sure the marchers didn't transgress any of the unwritten boundaries drawn through downtown Milan. There were a lot of territorial compromises back then. The protesters operated in an area beyond Largo Augusto. The fascists were entrenched in Piazza San Babila and its neighboring streets. If anybody crossed the line, there were incidents. Otherwise, nothing happened. It was like a lion and a lion tamer. We usually believe that the tamer is attacked by the lion, and that the tamer stops the attack by raising his whip or firing a blank. Wrong. The lion was fed and sedated before it entered the cage and doesn't feel like attacking anybody. Like all animals, it has its own space. If you don't invade that space, the lion remains calm. When the tamer steps forward, invading it, the lion roars. The tamer then raises his whip, but also takes a step backward, as if in expectation of a charge, whereupon the lion calms down. A simulated revolution must also have its rules. I went to the demonstration, but didn't march with any of the groups. Instead, I stood at the edge of Piazza Santo Stefano, where reporters, editors, and artists who had come to show their solidarity were milling around. The whole clientele of Pilades. I found myself standing next to Belbo and a woman I had often seen him with at the bar, who I thought was his companion. She later disappeared, and now I know why, having read about it in the file on Dr. Wagner. "What are you doing here?" I asked. "You know how it is," he said, smiling, embarrassed. "We have to save our souls somehow. Crede fermiter et pecca fortiter. Doesn't this scene remind you of something?" I looked around. It was a sunny afternoon, one of those days when Milan is beautiful, yellow facades and a softly metallic sky. The police across the square were armored with helmets and plastic shields that gave off glints like steel. A plainclothes officer, girded with a gaudy tricolor sash, strutted up and down in front of his men. I turned and looked at the head of the march. People weren't moving, they were marking time. They were lined up in ranks, but the rows were irregular, almost serpentine, and the crowd seemed to bristle with pikes, standards, banners, sticks. Impatient groups chanted rhythmic slogans. Along the flanks of the procession, activists darted back and forth, wearing red kerchiefs over their faces, motley shirts, studded belts, and jeans that had known much rain and sun. Even the rolled-up flags that concealed the incongruous weapons looked like dabs of color on a palette. I thought of Dufy, his gaiety. Freely associating, I went from Dufy to Guillaume Dufay. I had the impression of being in a Flemish miniature. In the little crowds gathered on either side of the marchers, I glimpsed some androgynous women waiting for the great display of daring they had been promised. But all this went through my mind in a flash, as if I were reliving some other experience without recognizing it. "It's the taking of Ascalon, isn't it?" Belbo said. "By the Lord St. James, my good sir," I replied, "this is truly a crusader's combat. I do believe that this night some of these men will be in paradise." "No doubt," Belbo said. "But can you tell me where the Saracens are?" "Well, the police are definitely Teutonic," I observed, "which would make us the hordes of Alexander Nevsky. But I'm getting my texts mixed up. Look at that group over there. They must be the companions of the Comte d'Artois, eager to enter the fray, for they will brook no offense, and already they head for the enemy lines, shouting threats to provoke the infidel." That was when it happened. I don't remember it that clearly. The marchers had started moving, and a group of activists with chains and ski masks began to force their way through the police lines toward Piazza San Babila, yelling. The lion was on the move. The front line of police parted, and the fire hoses appeared. The first ball bearings, then the first stones, came hurtling from the forward positions of the demonstration. A cordon of police advanced, swinging clubs, and the procession recoiled. At that moment, in the distance, from the far end of Via Laghetto, a shot was heard. Maybe it was only a tire exploding, or a firecracker. Maybe it was a popgun shot from one of those groups that in a few years would regularly be using P-38s. Panic. The police drew their weapons, trumpet blasts for a charge were heard. The march split into two groups. One, militants who were ready to fight, and one, all the others, who considered their duty done. I found myself running along Via Larga with the mad fear of being hit by some blunt object, such as a club. Suddenly Belbo and his companion were beside me, running fast, but without panic. At the corner of Via Rastrelli, Belbo grabbed me by the arm. "This way, kid," he said. I wanted to ask why. Via Larga seemed much more spacious and peopled, and claustrophobia overcame me in the maze of alleys between Via Pecorari and the Archbishop's Palace. It seemed to me that where Belbo was going there were fewer places to hide or blend in if the police intercepted us. But he signaled me to be quiet, turned two or three corners, and gradually slowed down. We found ourselves walking unhurriedly, right behind a cathedral, where traffic was normal and no echoes came from the battle taking place less than 200 meters away. Still silent, we walked around the cathedral and finally came to the side facing the Galleria. Belbo bought a bag of corn and began feeding the pigeons with seraphic pleasure. We blended into the Saturday crowd completely. Belbo and I were in jackets and ties, and the girl had on the uniform of a Milanese lady, a gray turtleneck with a strand of pearls. Cultured, or maybe not. Belbo introduced us. "This is Sandra. You two know each other?" "By sight. Hi." "You see, Kasaban," Belbo said to me then, "you must never flee in a straight line. Napoleon III, following the example of the Savoys in Turin, had Paris disemboweled, then turned it into the network of boulevards we all admire today. A masterpiece of intelligent city planning. Except that those broad, straight streets are also ideal for controlling angry crowds. Where possible, even the side streets were made broad and straight, like the Champs-Élysées. Where it wasn't possible, in the little streets of the Latin Quarter, for example, that's where May 68 was seen to its best advantage. When you flee, head for alleys. No police force can guard them all, and even the police are afraid to enter them in small numbers. If you run into a few on their own, they're more frightened than you are, and both parties take off, in opposite directions. Anytime you're going to a mass rally in an area you don't know well, reconnoiter the neighborhood the day before and stand at the corner where the little streets start." "Did you take a course in Bolivia, or what?" "Survival techniques are learned only in childhood, unless as an adult you enlist in the Green Berets. I had some bad experiences during the war when the partisans were active around..." Name left blank. He said, naming a town between Monferrato and the Langhe. "We had been evacuated from the city in 43, a great idea, exactly the time and place to savor everything. Mass arrests, the SS, gunfire in the streets. One evening I was going up the hill to get some fresh milk from a farm, and I heard a sound up in the trees. Frr, frr. I realized that some men on a distant hill were machine-gunning the railroad line in the valley behind me. My instinct was to run, or just dive to the ground. I made a mistake. I ran toward the valley, and suddenly I heard a chuck-chuck-chuck in the field around me. Some of the shots were falling short of the railroad. That's when I learned that if they're shooting from a high hill down at a valley, then you should run uphill. The higher you go, the higher the bullets will be over your head. Once my grandmother was caught in a shootout between fascists and partisans deployed on opposite sides of a cornfield. Wherever she ran, she risked stopping a bullet. So she just flung herself down in the middle of the field, right in the line of fire, and lay there for 10 minutes, her face in the dirt, hoping that neither side would advance very far. She was lucky. When you learn these things as a child, they are hardwired in your nervous system." "So you were in the resistance." "As a spectator," he said. I sensed a slight embarrassment in his voice. "In 1943 I was 11, and at the end of the war, barely 13. Too young to take part, but old enough to follow everything with, how shall I put it, photographic attention. What else could I do? I watched. And ran. Like today." "You should write about it instead of editing other people's books." "It's all been told, Kasaban. If I'd been 20 back then, in the 50s, I'd have written a poetic memoir. Luckily, I was born too late for that. By the time I was old enough to write, all I could do was read books that were already written. On the other hand, I could also have ended up on that hill with a bullet in my head." "From which side?" I asked, then immediately regretted the question. "Sorry, I was just kidding." "No, you weren't." "Sure, today I know, but what did I know then? You can be obsessed by remorse all your life. Not because you chose the wrong thing, you can always repent, atone, but because you never had the chance to prove to yourself that you would have chosen the right thing. I was a potential traitor. What truth does that entitle me now to teach to others? "Excuse me," I said, "but potentially you are also a Jack the Ripper. This is neurotic, unless your remorse is based on something specific." "What does that mean?" "But speaking of neurosis, this evening there's a dinner party for Dr. Wagner. Let's take a taxi at Piazza della Scala. Coming, Sandra?"
"Dr. Wagner?" I asked, about to take my leave of them. "In person?"
"Yes, he's in Milan for a few days, and maybe I'll be able to persuade him to give us some of his unpublished essays for a little volume. It would be a real coup." So Belbo was in contact with Dr. Wagner even then. I wondered if that was the evening Wagner psychoanalyzed Belbo free of charge, without either of them knowing it. But perhaps this happened later. In any case, that was the first time I heard Belbo talk about his childhood in name omitted. Strange, he talked about running away, investing it with a kind of heroism, in the glorious light of memory. But the memory had come back to him only after, with me as accomplice but also as witness, he had unheroically, if wisely, run away again. Chapter 16. After which, Brother Etienne de Provins, brought into the presence of the aforesaid officials and asked by them to defend the order, said he did not wish to. If the masters wished to defend it, they could, but before his arrest he had been in the order only 9 months. Deposition, November 27, 1309. In Abulafia I found other tales of Belbo's running away, and I thought about them that evening as I stood in the darkness in the periscope, listening to a sequence of rustling sounds, squeaks, creaks, and telling myself not to panic, because that was how museums, libraries, and antique palaces talk to themselves at night. It is only old cupboards settling, window frames reacting to the evening's humidity, plaster crumbling at a miserly millimeter per century rate, walls yawning. "You can't run away," I told myself. "You're here to learn what happened to a man who, in a mad or desperate act of courage, tried once and for all to stop running away, perhaps in order to hasten his encounter, so many times postponed, with the truth." File name, Canal. Was it from a police charge, or once again from history, that I ran away? Does it make any difference? Did I go to the march because of a moral choice, or to subject myself to yet another test of opportunity? Granted, I was either too early or too late for all the great opportunities, but that was the fault of my birth date. I would have liked to be in that field of bullets, shooting, even at the price of hitting Granny. But I was absent because of age, not because of cowardice. All right. And what about the march? Again, I ran away for a generational reason. It was not my conflict. But I could have taken the risk even so, without enthusiasm, to prove that if I had been in the field of bullets, I would have known how to choose. Does it make sense to choose the wrong opportunity just to convince yourself that you would have chosen the right one, had you the opportunity? I wonder how many of those who opt for fighting today do it for that reason. But a contrived opportunity is not the right opportunity. Can you call yourself a coward simply because the courage of others seems to you out of proportion to the triviality of the occasion? Thus wisdom creates cowards, and thus you miss opportunity while spending your life on the lookout for it. You have to seize opportunity instinctively, without knowing at the time that it is the opportunity. Is it possible that I really did seize it once without knowing? How can you feel like a coward because you were born in the wrong decade? The answer? You feel like a coward because once you were a coward. But suppose you passed up the opportunity because you felt it was inadequate. Describe the house in name omitted. Isolated on the hill among the vineyards, don't they call those breast-shaped hills? And then the road that led to the edge of town, to the last row of houses, or the first, depending on the direction you come from. The little evacuee who abandons the protection of his family and ventures into the tentacular town, walking the broad avenue, skirting the alley he so enviously fears. The alley was the gathering place of the alley gang. Country boys, dirty, loud. I was too citified. Better to stay away from them. But to reach the square and the newspaper kiosk and the stationery store, unless I essayed a circumnavigation almost equatorial and quite undignified, the only course was to go along the canal.
and the boys of the alley gang were little gentlemen compared to the canal gang, named after a former stream, now a drainage ditch, that ran through the poorest part of town. The canal kids were filthy sub-proletarians and violent. The alley kids couldn't cross the canal area without being attacked and beaten up. At first I didn't know that I was an alley kid. I had just arrived, but already the canal gang had identified me as an enemy. I walked through their area with a children's magazine open before my face, reading as I went. They saw me. I ran. They chased me, throwing stones. One stone went right through a page of the magazine, which I was still holding in front of me as I ran, trying to retain a little dignity. I got away, but lost the magazine. The next day, I decided to join the alley gang. I presented myself at their Sanhedrin and was greeted with cackles. My hair was very thick at the time, and it tended to stand up on my head, a bit like Struwwelpeter's. The style in those days, as shown in movies and ads or on Sunday strolls after Mass, featured young men with broad-shouldered, double-breasted jackets, greased mustaches, and gleaming hair combed straight back and stuck to their skulls. And that's what I wanted, sleek hair like that. In the market square, on a Monday, I spent what for me was an enormous sum on some boxes of brilliantine thick as beanflower honey. Then I spent hours smearing it on until my hair was laminated. A leaden cap, a kimono. Then I put on a net to keep my hair tightly compressed. The alley gang had seen me go by wearing the net and had shouted taunts in that harsh dialect of theirs, which I understood but couldn't speak. That particular day, after staying 2 hours in the house with the net on, I took it off, checked the splendid result in the mirror, and set out to meet the gang to which I hoped to swear allegiance. I approached them just as the brilliantine was losing its glutinous power and my hair was again assuming, in slow motion, its vertical position. The light among the alley kids, in a circle around me, nudging one another, I asked to be admitted. Unfortunately, I spoke in Italian. An outsider. Their leader, Martinetti, who seemed a giant to me then, came forward, splendid, barefoot. He decided I should undergo 100 kicks in the behind. Maybe the kicks were meant to reawaken the serpent Kundalini. I agreed and stood against the wall. 2 sergeants held my arms, and I received 100 barefoot kicks. Martinetti applied himself to his task with vigor and skill, striking sideways so he wouldn't hurt his toes. The gang served as chorus for the ritual, keeping count in their dialect. Then they shut me up in a rabbit hutch for half an hour while they passed the time in guttural conversation. They let me out when I complained that my legs were numb. I was proud because I had been able to stand up to the liturgy of a savage tribe. I was a man called Horse. In those days were stationed Latter-day Teutonic Knights, who were not particularly alert because the partisans hadn't yet made themselves felt. This was toward the end of 43, the beginning of 44. One of our first exploits was to slip into a shed, while some of us flattered the soldier on guard duty, a great Longobard eating an enormous sandwich of, we thought and were horrified, salami and jam. The decoys distracted the German, praising his weapons, while the rest of us crept through some loose planks in the back of the shed and stole a few sticks of TNT. I don't believe the explosive was ever used subsequently, but the idea was, according to Martinetti's plan, to set it off in the countryside for purely pyrotechnical purposes and by methods I now know were very crude and would not have worked. Later, the Germans were replaced by the fascist Marines of the Decima Mas, who set up a roadblock near the river, right at the crossroads where the girls from the school of Santa Maria Auxiliatrice came down the avenue at 6 in the evening. Martinetti convinced the Decima Marines, who couldn't have been over 18, to tie together a bunch of hand grenades left by the Germans, the ones with a long pin, and remove the safeties so they could explode at the water's edge at the exact moment the girls arrived. Martinetti knew how to calculate the timing. He explained it to the fascists, and the effect was prodigious. A sheet of water rose up along the bank in a thunderous din, just as the girls were turning the corner. General flight, much squeaking, and we and the fascists split our sides laughing. The survivors of Allied imprisonment would remember that day of glory, second only to the burning of Mole. The chief amusement of the alley kids was collecting shell cases and other war residue, which, after September 8th and the German occupation of Italy, were plentiful. Old helmets, cartridge pouches, knapsacks, sometimes live bullets. This is what you did with a good bullet. Holding the shell case in one hand, you stuck the projectile into a keyhole, twisted it, and pulled out the case, adding it to your collection. The gunpowder was emptied out, sometimes there were thin strips of ballastite, and deposited in serpentine trails that were set alight. The casings, especially prized if the caps were intact, went to enrich one's army. A good collector would have a lot of them arranged in rows by make, color, shape, and origin. There were squads of foot soldiers, which were submachine gun and Sten casings, then squires and knights, which were 1891 rifle shells. We saw Garands only after the Americans came. And finally, a boy's supreme ambition, towering grandmasters, which were empty machine gun shells. One evening, as we were absorbed in these peaceful pursuits, Martinetti informed us that the moment had come. A challenge had been sent to the canal gang, and they had accepted. The battle was to take place on neutral ground, behind the station, that night, at 9. It was late afternoon on a summer day, enervating but charged with excitement. We decked ourselves out in the most terrifying paraphernalia, looking for pieces of wood that could be easily gripped, filling pouches and knapsacks with stones of various sizes. Some of us made whips out of rifle slings, awesome if wielded with decision. During those twilight hours we all felt like heroes, me most of all. It was the excitement before the attack, bitter, painful, splendid. "So long, Mama. I'm off to Yokohama." "Send the word over there." We were sacrificing our youth to the fatherland, just as they had taught us in school before September 8th. Martinetti's plan was shrewd. We would cross the railroad embankment farther to the north and come at them from behind, take them by surprise, and thus would be victors from the start. Then, no quarter would be granted. At dusk, we crossed the embankment, scrambling up ramps and across gullies, loaded down with stones and clubs. From the crest of the embankment, we saw them lying in ambush behind the station latrines. But they saw us, too, because they were watching their backs, suspecting we would arrive from that direction. The only thing for us to do was to move in without giving them time for astonishment at the obviousness of our ploy. Nobody had passed around any grappa before we went over the top, but we flung ourselves into battle anyway, yelling. Then came the turning point, when we were about 100 meters from the station. There stood the first houses of the town, and though they were few, they created a web of narrow paths. There the boldest group dashed forward, fearless, while I, and luckily for me, a few others, slowed down and ducked behind the corners of the houses to watch from a distance. If Martinetti had organized us into vanguard and rear guard, we would have done our duty, but this was a spontaneous deployment, those with guts in front and the cowards behind. So from our refuges, mine was farther back than the others, we observed the conflict, which never took place. The two groups came within a few meters of each other and stood in confrontation, snarling. Then the leaders stepped forward to confer. Yalta. They decided to divide their territories into zones, and agreed to allow an occasional safe conduct pass, like Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. Solidarity between groups of knights had prevailed over the ineluctability of battle. Each side had proved itself. The opposing camps withdrew in harmony, still opponents, in opposite directions. Now I tell myself that I didn't rush into the attack because I found it laughable, but that's not what I told myself then. Then I felt like a coward, and that was that. Today, even more cowardly, I tell myself that as it turned out I would have risked nothing had I charged with the others, and my life afterward would have been better. I missed opportunity at the age of 12. If you fail to have an erection the first time, you are impotent for the rest of your life. A month later, some random trespass brought the alley and canal gangs face to face in a field, and clods of earth began to fly. I don't know whether it was because the outcome of the earlier conflict had reassured me, or because I desired martyrdom, but one way or another, this time I stood in the front line. A clod which concealed a stone struck my lip and split it. I ran home crying, and my mother had to use the tweezers from her toilet case to pick pieces of earth out of the wound on the inside of my lip. In fact, I was left with a lump next to the lower right canine, and even now, when I run my tongue over it, I feel a vibration, a shudder. But this lump does not absolve me, because I got it through heedlessness, not through courage. I run my tongue over my lip, and what do? I write. But bad literature brings no redemption. After the day of the march, I didn't see Belbo again for about a year. I fell in love with Amparo and stopped going to Pilates, or at least the few times I did drop in with Amparo, Belbo wasn't there. Amparo didn't like the place anyway. In her moral and political severity, equaled only by her grace, her magnificent pride, she considered Pilates a clubhouse for liberal dandies, and liberal dandyism, as far as she was concerned, was a subtle thread in the fabric of the capitalist plot. For me, this was a year of great commitment, seriousness, and enchantment. I worked joyfully but serenely on my thesis. Then one day I ran into Belbo along the Navilly, not far from the Garamond office.
"Well, look who's here," he said cheerfully. "My favorite Templar.
Listen, I've just been presented with a bottle of ineffably ancient nectar. Why don't you come up to the office? I have paper cups and a free afternoon."
"Azugma," I said.
"No, bourbon, and bottled, I believe, before the fall of the Alamo." I followed him. We had just taken the first sip when Gudrun came in and said there was a gentleman to see Belbo. He slapped his forehead. He had forgotten the appointment. "But chance has a taste for conspiracy," he said to me. From what he had gathered, this individual wanted to show him a book that concerned the Templars. "I'll get rid of him quickly," he said, "but you must lend me a hand with some keen objections." It had surely been chance, and so I was caught in the net.